Welcome back to Offworld, the show where we talk about all things space exploration and pop culture. I'm Ariel Waldman.
And I'm Norm Chan. The topic of this week's episode, well, it's popped up in a lot of movies and some TV shows. We're talking about asteroids.
Yeah, they show up kind of everywhere. But that said, I feel like, you know, we get one version of asteroids for the most part in a lot of like films like Star Wars and Star Trek. And, you know, I kind of wanted to know more about like the diversity of asteroids and are we actually depicting them in the way that they actually are?
Especially since we're seeing asteroids just not just being objects of destruction, meteorites falling on planets, but also as potential resources in the real science. So you have two great guests this week who are experts in the field, and let's hear them chat.
Okay, so today we are talking about all things asteroids. Both of you are asteroid geeks. Please introduce yourself, Michael, and what it is that you do.
Okay, I'm Michael Bush. I work as a research scientist at the SETI Institute at the south end of the peninsula these days. Mostly I do radar observations of near-Earth asteroids as they pass near the Earth. A lot of stuff lately has been targets for asteroid spacecraft missions because there are a lot of such missions right now. And it's been fun to see those happen.
Yeah, and Alessandra?
Hi, I'm Alessandra Springman. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Arizona. Most people call me Sandy, and I study asteroids and comets. I study their surfaces, and for the comets, I study what comes off of them in terms of dust and gas, nasty things like cyanide.
Okay, so I'm really excited to talk about asteroids today because I feel like it's something that on one hand, asteroids come up a lot in science fiction movies, either flying through them or living on them or what have you. And on the other hand, there's kind of not a lot of diversity in how asteroids are represented in films, or at least that's how I feel. But first and foremost, I want to ask, like, how did you get into asteroids? What made you become an asteroid geek?
I had a professor in undergrad who he studied asteroids, and he recruited a number of students to observe asteroids for him. And it was my sophomore year of college. I'd had some math, I'd had some physics, I'd had some computer science, and he sort of explained his whole scientific research program to me. And it, like, I had enough math, and I had enough physics, and I had enough computer science to sort of understand everything. And I remember sort of stumbling back to my dorm around 2 a.m. after I was done observing, thinking, yep, this is what I want to do from now on.
Fair enough. Michael, what about you? Was there like some spark or something that got you into asteroids specifically?
So I had been interested in planetary astronomy for a very long time. Too much Carl Sagan as a young kid, maybe. I don't know.
Is there such a thing?
15 years ago, I was studying physics and astronomy as an undergraduate student. Steve Ostro, who was working down at JPL at the time in Pasadena, offered me a job as a grad student studying asteroids and making sure they weren't going to fall out of the sky anytime soon. It sounded cool. So far, things have worked out.
It's good to know they're not falling out of the sky too often, or at least not too largely too often. So breaking it down just for people who maybe aren't asteroid geeks or are interested in knowing more about asteroids, are they just made up of rocks? Like, what are asteroids made up of? Are they made up of everything? Unicorn dust? What have you? Like, what are the different types of asteroids that exist?
So there are about a million asteroids that we know of.
I think we're about 750,000 or so.
Yeah.
I lose count.
Eventually, there'll probably be about a million asteroids that we know about, and they hang out between Mars and Jupiter in our solar system, and they're mostly made of rock, similar to things that you would see here on Earth. But some of them are actually from the cores of failed planets. They're made out of iron. They're made out of nickel. This is a iron-nickel meteorite, and that's from?
And this is from a place called Campo de Celio these days in Argentina.
Cool.
It fell out of the sky a few thousand years ago.
Yeah, and for the podcast listeners, essentially we're looking at like a little sort of golf ball size piece of black metal that is kind of misshapen and as if it got run over by a train or something.
So that's nickel and iron, like the core of the Earth, the core of Mars. We see a few large asteroids in the main asteroid belt, Psyche, Cleopatra, that are mostly metal. We've heard they had rock on the outside and it got broken apart. Meteorites that are made of metal are by far the easiest to find on Earth because you don't confuse them for regular Earth rocks. But far more common are stony and we call carbonaceous asteroids. So they're rock. They're rock with a certain amount of water, a certain amount of carbon mixed in, along with some other things, which Sandy is the expert on.
So this meteorite, and for our listeners, it looks like a dark piece of rock about the size of a thumbprint, and it's got these little white specks in it. And those white specks are actually the first things that solidified in the solar system 4.6 billion years ago. They're older than the Earth. So this little chunk of asteroid, we think material like this formed the Earth 4.6 billion years ago.
Wow.
And this fell in the 1960s, right before the astronauts were going to go to the moon for Apollo. So all these labs had been set up to study material from space. So Allende, which fell in Mexico in the 60s, was sort of this perfect test subject. And people are now pretty sure that material like this formed the Earth, formed most of the rocky planets in our part of the solar system.
And when you say material like this and those white specks, what exactly are you talking about?
These white specks are calcium and aluminum, and also the material around it. It has a lot of carbon. It has pretty much every element on the periodic table up to iron.
Okay.
And various minerals.
So lots of rocks, lots of metal. I've also heard of perhaps silica asteroids or asteroids that maybe have more glass-like sort of features. Am I wrong on that? Or is it mostly metal and rock?
So say rock, that's typically going to be silicate of some kind. So silicon, oxygen, and then magnesium, calcium, sodium, whatever other mixture of elements. The geologists can give you the full vocabulary for all of those minerals. If you take a rocky asteroid and you hit it with an impact, which does happen, asteroids are into each other rarely, then some of the stuff gets melted and it cools down very quickly rather than getting large crystals like we see in something like Allende that hasn't been melted like this, you get glass. That also happens if you run an asteroid into a planet. So there's stuff called tektites, which are bits of refrozen debris from asteroids hitting the ground on the Earth.
Yeah.
They also form out of Earth rock that gets mixed up in that whole process. But there's some asteroid material in there, too.
Yeah. So you talked about earlier about most of the asteroids that we know about are in the asteroid belt. You know, what is it that causes asteroids to really actually clump into fields? And you know, are solo asteroids pretty rare? Or, you know, are asteroids always gravitating towards, pun intended, I guess, being in fields? Or are there are a lot of free-flying asteroids that aren't part of the asteroid belt?
So most of us, when we think of asteroids, we think about Empire Strikes Back. We think of the Millennium Falcon, and the odds of successfully navigating an asteroid field are rather not in their favor, let's say. But in real life, asteroids are not in fields like that. They don't clump so much together. If you had an asteroid the size of a potato, the closest one would maybe be several kilometers away. So maybe, you know, we're here in the Mission District in San Francisco. Maybe it would be on the ocean side of the peninsula.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess fields, broadly. So there's the asteroid belt, which isn't like a field that you've got to navigate through, but it's still a ring of asteroids that have sort of decided to be in a ring together.
So it's actually more of the other way around. The main asteroid belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter is there because Jupiter formed first, and it scattered the orbits of everything in the asteroid belt.
It's a big bully.
They couldn't clump up to give us another planet like Mars. But the asteroids' orbits keep getting perturbed a little bit, so they spread out in space. And some of them don't stay in the asteroid belt. They escape out to the outer solar system. Some of them come into the inner solar system and cross the orbit of the Earth, which is great if you want to send spacecraft to them because they are relatively nearby. It's a little awkward because occasionally they hit the Earth.
Well, yeah.
As the dinosaurs experienced 66 million years ago.
Right. Well, I mean, let's talk about, you know, them being sort of nearby, because so the Expanse is one science fiction, you know, area where I feel there's a lot of depictions about asteroids. You've got the whole Belters community of people who are actually living among the asteroid belt and sort of mining it. And, you know, I guess a big question is, you know, could we actually have miners, I guess robotic or human, sort of at the asteroid belt? Is that something that's being looked into, or is that something that's plausible?
So we have a couple of asteroid mining companies now. When you have one company, they're sort of out there, they're kind of weirdos. But when you have two asteroid mining companies, that's a respectable industry. And so the technology might not be quite there yet, but the idea is to find an asteroid, then send a spacecraft to it and try to gather up material to create sort of a more sustained human and robotic presence in space. Because if you can get water for drinking or to split into rocket fuel or to use for shielding your habitat, that means you don't have to bring it from Earth. There are a couple asteroid missions out there right now that are not quite focused on asteroid mining, but they're doing science that is relevant for asteroid mining. So they're looking at the surfaces of these objects. They're looking to see where the minerals are, if our hypotheses about these asteroids being made of material that would have water locked up in hydrated minerals would be there. So the idea of asteroid mining actually isn't too far-fetched.
And what are those missions that you're referencing?
There are a couple of missions at asteroids right now. The first one that arrived at an asteroid in the last couple of years was the Japanese mission Hayabusa 2, which is visiting an asteroid called Ryugu, which we think has a very similar composition to this meteorite Allende. Not quite the same, but we think that the material on Ryugu hasn't changed too much in the past 4.5 billion years. There's another mission that's being run by NASA that's at an asteroid called Bennu, and that mission is OSIRIS-REx, which has a very tortured acronym. But the goal of this mission is to find out more about this asteroid, and one of the goals is to also maybe to look at this asteroid in the context of mining in the future.
Now, both OSIRIS-REx, Hayabusa 2, and other asteroid missions focused on Earth Space Resources side of people proposed but haven't flown yet, those are all focusing on near-Earth asteroids. Because from the standpoint of doing science, you want sample return missions to bring asteroid material that hasn't fallen through the sky and gotten partially melted back for analysis, then it helps that they're already on near-Earth orbits because they're easy to get back from. Similarly, if you are talking space resource utilization and you want to haul back however many tons of water or sandbags to protect astronauts from radiation, it's convenient if it's easy to get back from. So people aren't talking about the asteroid belt in terms of space resources right now. Something like The Expanse, where it's in the late 23rd century or whenever it is supposedly set. They have humans on Mars that are getting resources from the asteroid belt, and it's on a much larger scale.
Yeah.
So that's outside anything that's currently happening.
Yeah, well, yeah, of course. Well, I mean, this is what I love about, you know, the intersection of sci-fi and science is sort of like where we might begin meeting in the middle. You know, once we were to get on an asteroid, be it with one of these space probes or in a more expanse-like fantastical future, you know, what sort of tools would we need to actually mine it? Has anyone started proposing different, you know, I guess drills or things of that nature? Or like, you know, is there anything that we would want from a metal asteroid and how we would get it?
So these asteroid surfaces, most of the near Earth asteroids aren't like a solid piece of rock, like a brick. They're actually a whole bunch of pieces of gravel and boulders loosely stuck together in what in polite company we call a gravitational aggregate, and more casually we call a rubble pile. So this asteroid that Michael's holding kind of has this top shape with this ridge around it, and the material in the ridge is actually barely bound to this asteroid gravitationally. Mm. It's just floating there. These asteroids are sort of these microgravity environments. And so you can't go out to this asteroid with a shovel and just dig, because the material is going to stick to your shovel in kind of a way you don't expect. So the OSIRIS-REx mission, which is a sample return mission, they actually have a touch-and-go sample return canister that has what looks like an engine air filter, where gas is shot out of this engine air filter, and it's going to move material from the surface into this collector. So you're going to have to, when it comes to asteroid mining in the future, sort of get out of thinking like an Earthling, thinking about, you know, taking gravity for granted. And you're going to have to work to make new technologies and new ways of getting material off a surface in microgravity environments.
The Hayabusa 2 spacecraft followed a somewhat different design strategy than OSIRIS-REx. Rather than spraying a jet of high-pressure nitrogen gas at the surface, they actually slammed a pellet into the ground. And they took video of this, and you can go see all of the debris flying around the spacecraft every which way. But some of it got into the sample container, and that's what they'll bring back. If you talk about bringing much larger masses, people have talked about ways to do that. There was a project proposed by NASA called the Asteroid Redirect Mission, which would have, among other things, brought back about 50 tons from an asteroid called 2008 EV5, which was is shaped like this. The idea is they would land somewhere on the surface of the asteroid, pick up a rock, and bring it back. But how do you pick up 50 tons of material? you have to have some complicated system of legs or grabbers or something, and then you have to pull on it. So this stuff actually ends up being somewhat sticky.
Yeah, that's interesting because I feel like I haven't really seen any depictions like that in movies. You know, I mean, obviously, like the most typical asteroid movie that many of us remember is Armageddon. But it's got that. It's a sort of a keystone moment in our cultural, for better or worse. Armageddon is sort of that. Sort of moment where a lot of people are like, oh yeah, asteroids, and we have to do something about them, and maybe not send Bruce Willis to it, but how would we implant a explosive in it if we had to? How would we send people to it if we had to? And I feel like it was perhaps one of the first science fiction movies of the modern era that got people thinking about that. So, like it or don't like it, it's got its place in history. But now we've got these great, more modern day things with Star Wars is going to a lot of different locations. I feel like Star Trek Discovery may have had some asteroid moments as well, capturing an asteroid, and of course The Expanse. And it's interesting that, this idea that asteroids are sticky or something hasn't really been really depicted. We're still
when we say that rubble piles of rock are sticky.
Yeah,
sticky is relative. The gravity on these things is 10,000 times less than what we have in this room sitting here.
Sticky, so like styrofoam, like the static cling.
Sticky like flour or gravel or sand.
I guess there's also the other side of it. We're talking about a lot of how you would sort of mine asteroids with robots or other devices, but of course also that comes up sometimes is actually having civilizations on asteroids. So again, I keep going back to it, but in The Expanse you have people living on Eros, you have people living on Ceres. If we were to start thinking about making an asteroid habitable for humans, like how many different things would we have to be evaluating how to do it?
So Ceres and Vesta, the really large ones, they're sending humans to them. People have thought about this in some degree. That's a lot more like sending humans to the moon than it is to going to the really small asteroids because they're large. They have significant gravity. Maybe it's 10% of what we have in this room or 5%, but it's not negligible. Mm-hmm. You jump on Ceres, you will come back to the ground. You jump on Hayabusa's target, Ryugu, you may or may not go back to the surface, and it may take you a few weeks before you land back on the ground, if you do. That's a very different situation for human habitat.
Yeah, so Ceres is a kind of like a dwarf planet in a sense. What about Eros? And I guess, is that thinking about a much smaller sort of asteroid and how humans would have to actually cope with that?
So Eros is what, 30 kilometers long, roughly?
It's a relatively large near-Earth asteroid.
Although its orbit is such that it comes near the Earth, it also goes way out into the main asteroid belt. Mm. So I worked it out. The Expanse, actually, the timelines it takes them to get from Eros to Ceres and back and forth, that actually works.
It's good to know.
Of course, then they move Eros and everything goes sideways.
But yeah.
In any event, talking about humans inside Eros, they dig inside. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's what you would want to do on something that small.
You'd
want to
be on the surface.
Might just take parts of the asteroid off and form them into a shell and hang out inside that.
Oh, sort of making an exoskeleton of an asteroid?
If you want gravity, which humans tend to like, you may want to spin the asteroid. But if it's a pile of rubble, you spin it, it flies apart. And we have on the table in front of us here an example of what happens when rubble piles spin too fast. Things fly off into space, and then you get little moons around them. If they spin really fast, they just explode.
So
you have to have some way to hold them together that's stronger than the rubble pile being a little sticky.
Sonny, you're laughing
a
lot.
Just, if I were going to put a human city on an asteroid, I would not choose Eros. I would probably go somewhere like Ceres, which might have some hydrated minerals where you can get water. It has some salts. It's got a little more gravity. It would take a long time to get there, but it would probably be a slightly more stable sort of human habitat.
Yeah, well, and the interesting thing that they do with Ceres is that they create like a centrifuge sort of with humans inside so that they have more gravity. Mm-hmm. So they've invented some way to spin up entire asteroids in order to try and create something similar to gravity. So
people talk about an actual application. It's we make sandbags and we strap them on the outside of our habitat and the humans live inside that, as opposed to if we're going to dig inside the rubble pile.
So we keep talking about shielding just real fast that here on Earth, we've got this great atmosphere. It blocks cosmic rays. It's really fantastic. It helps us not, you know, get bombarded by that type of radiation. But out in space, you don't have that shielding. So you need water or rock or something between you and cosmic rays.
Astronauts in the International Space Station have some amount of shielding from the Earth's magnetic field. If you go out to the moon, you don't have that. The Apollo astronauts were only out there for a week at a time. They got lucky. If you're doing 6 months from here to Mars, you may want some more radiation shielding.
Yeah, for sure. Well, so
and it's really heavy to haul up from the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and I think that's the thing that a lot of people maybe haven't shown as much is like how much asteroid mining might be only used for resources in space rather than anything brought back down to Earth. I see a lot of times in popular media people talking about being, you know, trillionaires because there's like a diamond asteroid or something along those lines. And of course, like bringing that stuff back to Earth is actually pretty difficult, right?
You're not going to be dropping the bottom out of the rare earth metal market on Earth anytime soon by mining asteroids. Don't hold your breath.
Well, yeah, and so break that down a little bit of just why is it that people can't just take a bunch of stuff from an asteroid, bring it back to Earth, and then make trillions of dollars?
So this nickel iron meteorite that we have on the table in front of us is about, what is this one, 40 parts per million platinum group metals by weight, which is about what people mine in platinum mines in South Africa, I'm told. But those are on the ground. It's really, really expensive to go out to space, sieve out 20 parts per million of something, and then haul all that back to the Earth. This really disappointed me when I first understood it.
Right. Yeah, well, I mean, this is what...
Then it's all, you would have to sieve through a million times the mass of your spacecraft to make any money.
Yeah, that might be a little bit difficult.
So, also, the price of platinum is kind of artificially inflated on Earth because it's rare. You add more of it, there might be a price crash, and then the model doesn't really work anymore.
Yeah, there are some economics to work out. So you had mentioned a couple of missions, OSIRIS-REx and Hayabusa 2. What other asteroid missions are in the works or already out there that are interesting?
So there's two U.S. missions. One is called Psyche, which will go to this metal asteroid, similar in composition mostly to this iron-nickel meteorite. And we think it's sort of the core of a failed asteroid. And we see a couple other metal asteroids out there. There's one called Cleopatra, which is a metallic dog bone the size of New Jersey. So there's a bunch of them out there, and we haven't sent a mission to one. We haven't even sent a mission by one to photograph it. And we don't really know anything about these objects, but we do know that they're the core of an object, core of what was once a larger asteroid. So by studying these, you can study the center of asteroids and sort of the center of these planetesimals that were one building block and the step towards making our solar system that we have now. There's another mission called Lucy, which is going to go to Trojan asteroids of Jupiter. And Trojan asteroids are these asteroids that hang out in the same orbit as Jupiter. There's some 60 degrees in front of Jupiter, and there's some 60 degrees behind, and they're named after Trojan war heroes from the Greek and Trojan side. So this mission is going to go by objects in both of these clouds, behind Jupiter and in front of Jupiter, to study these objects, to see did they form with Jupiter, or were they swept up as Jupiter moved through the solar system.
Now, the Trojan asteroids are particularly interesting because they're far enough out, the outer asteroid belt does this too, that water ice is stable. So near-Earth asteroids, we don't really get water ice. There's water ice, it boils off into space like a comet, and Sandy can tell you more about that. But the Trojan asteroids, they're out there, they're cold enough, far away from the sun, that water ice is stable. So you've got a lot more water in those objects than you have in the inner asteroid belt. So there's this argument of where did the Earth's oceans come from? Did they come from things like the Trojan asteroids, the outer asteroid belt, or are they just what little bits of water is chemically bonded to other solid material?
Yeah,
so I don't know the answer to that question. Hopefully the spacecraft missions can help figure it out.
So when talking about these missions, you know, what does it exactly take to track and land on a asteroid? You know, I mean, that's kind of the basics. Like when we're talking about any of this science fiction of like, you know, Star Wars or anything else, you know, a lot of times they're just like, yeah, plug in some calculations and you're at the asteroid. The end, you know, is it just a lot of calculations and that's it? Or is there more sort of science needed from the actual spacecraft perspective to track and land?
So there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes into just getting an asteroid orbit that's good enough to send a spacecraft by it. But if you want to do like get an orbit around the asteroid like OSIRIS-REx, or if you want to do flybys of these Trojan asteroids, you need to know about the size of the object and their orbits more precisely. So when these asteroids are discovered, they're these asteroid survey telescopes. They open up at night, they take lots of photos of the sky, and they blink between two photos to see what has moved between two images. And if you see something moving, it's an asteroid. And so that's how baby asteroids get christened. And then people will do follow-up on the orbits, whether to say, okay, we think this might have a chance of hitting Earth, but it's pretty low. And so people will observe them more and they'll say, yep, this is not going to hit Earth anytime soon. Michael and I both have done asteroid radar astronomy at Arecibo Observatory and with the Goldstone Telescope in Southern California. And so if you get a radar ping to these asteroids, you can really refine their orbits. So a number of these asteroids have been chosen for missions because they've had their positions refined with radar, as well as their shape determined with radar. So you know where the asteroid is, what it's shaped like, and so that reduces sort of the risk of your mission, reduces the kind of unknowns when you get there.
To take one example, there's an asteroid called Tutatis. It has a pretty complicated rotation state, so it's tumbling around. If you are going to fly by the asteroid very close to the surface, as the Chinese Chang'e 2 spacecraft did some years ago, it really helps to know exactly how the asteroid is arranged in space. Otherwise, you might end up running into the surface as opposed to flying by.
That wouldn't be so good.
Especially given that they were flying by at almost 11 kilometers per second, so it was 5-6 miles a second. No, whatever that works out to, miles. Ends up, that would destroy the spacecraft. Fortunately, our radar measurements were correct, and they were able to fly the spacecraft about half a mile, 800 meters, away from the nearest part of the asteroid without any risk of collision.
Michael, what food item would you say this asteroid looks like?
So we have the people who are listening just to the audio. Tutatis has this contact binary shape, so two pieces stuck to each other. It gets compared to a diseased potato,
okay,
a sweet potato, a ginger root, two sticky rolls, although that one's a little awkward in this case. I also got suggested that it was like some Neolithic stone tool. You smash it into things. But
I'm going to go with like a ugly yam.
People make all sorts of shape comparisons for asteroids.
Yes.
So, many of them related to food.
So, okay. So we've talked about a lot about all these different aspects of asteroids, which has been absolutely fascinating. So my final question for both of you is, you know, what depictions do you not see in film of asteroids, given all of your knowledge of what they can actually end up being like, that you would like to see? What things would you like to see filmmakers try to depict about asteroids?
So I actually forgot one asteroid mission, and it's good that we're talking about depictions we'd like to see, because it's a mission called DART, which is a double asteroid redirection test. And so this spacecraft is going to go to an asteroid that has a moon, and they're going to put a kinetic impactor on the moon, which is a polite way of saying bomb, and they're going to explode the bomb, and they're going to see what happens to the moon. Does it deform the moon? Does it change its orbit at all? Could this help us with future asteroid impact mitigation if we think something's on a collision course with Earth? So I actually have a binary asteroid model there. It's the blue 3D print. And so this is about 3 kilometers across. The moon is about 800 meters. And we just don't see binary asteroids in movies. And I would like to see more of them.
Yeah. So by binary asteroid, you mean essentially well, what you're pointing to right now is a large asteroid with a smaller little moon going around it.
Yeah.
So little mini asteroid moons.
And some asteroids actually have two moons.
Yeah. Cute.
So the DART mission, which Sandy mentioned, in order to emphasize, the asteroid is going to Didymos. It cannot hit the Earth anytime soon. And they are demonstrating asteroid deflection by pushing it very slightly further away from the Earth.
They're going to push on Didymoon. Of Didymos.
Got it. So, Michael, what depiction would you like to see?
So, seeing the binaries and triple asteroids would be fun because, again, that's about 1 in 6 of the smaller asteroids, and I don't think even the Expanse has had one show up out of all the different places they've had their characters go. Also, we talk about asteroid deflection. It would be nice to see that done realistically. as compared to Armageddon and Deep Impact.
Something to sort of rewrite our collective minds about what it might be like.
And again, nobody's really done a big movie or TV show based on that. There are books that do it better, but...
Yeah, cool. Well, thank you both so much for being on the show today.
Thank you for having us. This has been great.
Ariel, I love that conversation, especially it just changed completely the way I think about asteroids, not just size and shape, but how, of course, in space, they would not behave like Earth.
Yeah, they're not just like a rock cluster and that's it. I thought it was really fascinating getting into how we would actually mine asteroids. It's not actually about necessarily taking a huge drill, but it might be just kind of trying to scoop up this static electric styrofoam-like sort of stuff around asteroids, more or less.
Yeah, the thing we would take for granted of drilling or harvesting or mining on Earth, having gravity, having a big thing, that none of that really applies when you're talking about microgravity and things of that scale. It changes how I think in the future, as we actually send robots up to asteroids, we might see it portrayed in popular media. But also, it's also a lot of fun to think about the hurling asteroid or spaceships landing on asteroid, but it might not be, you know, the Millennium Falcon.
Yeah, I think it's an important aspect that should maybe at least make some minor dents in how these are depicted in films, because asteroids show up whether or not you actually have a scene where you're flying through the, you know, typical asteroid field, which, you know, is always more dense than it is in real life. But, you know, whether or not you have that, as we continue to depict just humans going out into space, asteroids are a thing that you might encounter near Jupiter. You might encounter them kind of just a rogue asteroid going through. And so the way in which those are depicted, I think it would be much more fascinating if there was much more, I guess, richness in how they're shown rather than just a hurling rock.
Mm-hmm. And that's the physical depiction, but also maybe what's inside them as well, because just as much diversity in their composition, which then can lead to all different applications for resource acquisition, also what they like, the effects they have in relationship to each other. Very cool. Lots of fun stuff to talk about. We'll have more episodes of Offworld with more fun discussions. You can also listen to Offworld as a podcast if you go to test.com/offworld. The links are there. But if you're watching the video, thank you so much. And you can like and subscribe. And Ariel and I will see you next time.